Brothers and sisters, Namo Buddhaya. So first of all, I'd like to apologise for not being around much. Well, actually, probably it's for your benefit that I'm not. I'm feeling a little off colour, which, as the non-English won't understand what that means, I'm ill. It can even mean off colour, can even mean you're about to die, but in this case it's not that. I picked up something in Bombay which would have been better to leave there. I must admit, I'm also, as always when I come back from India, have a strong desire for solitude and nothing to do. So that's what I'm not doing. So somebody left this book outside my room last night, Sanghadeva. I'm very relieved that in the men's community somebody had a copy of Khonsa's Diamond Sutra. It would have been shameful if there hadn't been. This edition is actually very dear to me, not this particular copy, but this edition, because the very first retreat I went on, Dhammadina was present, I think Kamala Sheila might have been, I went into the town, nearby town, Hazelmere, and went to a second-hand bookshop, and from the shelves, a hardback version of this leapt at me. I took it back to the retreat and sat in the sun on the grass, trying to find my way into it, and I felt a sort of presence behind me. I looked up, and there I saw Bhante, looking thoroughly disreputable in a rather grubby robe with disheveled, long disheveled locks and a wicked toothy grin. And he was sort of looking over my shoulder and seeing what I was reading with a wonderful sort of delighted chuckle. My own Mahayana version of what happened then is that at that moment he predicted me to full and perfect Dhammacharihood. And he selected my name when I would be ordained. So I found it, and I found the passage that I was looking for. I'll read you what the Sanskrit says, I mean the full version says. The Lord asked, "What do you think, Subhuti? Is there any dharma which the Tathagata has fully known as the utmost right and perfect enlightenment? Or is there any dharma which the Tathagata has demonstrated?" Subhuti replied, "No, not as I understand what the Lord has said, and why. This dharma which the Tathagata has fully known or demonstrated, it cannot be grasped, it cannot be talked about. It is neither a dharma nor a no dharma. And why? Because an absolute exalts the holy persons." Full of these prajnaparamita whys, which don't actually get answered exactly. They get answered in a completely different way. So the word absolute is translates a Sanskrita. Here, well, he's translated as absolute, which isn't really, well, it's a bit misleading for us with our post-Hegelian sensitivities. I'm sure you have them, don't you? You can get surgery for it, but absolute just doesn't sound right, does it? A Sanskrita here doesn't mean unconditioned in the sense of not arising in dependence on conditions. It means unconditioned in the sense that it cannot be discriminated. You cannot know it with a discriminating mind. Samnya will not get it. It cannot be interpreted. Any interpretation, by definition, misses it, because it is a tarkavacharo. It's beyond the reach of reason. So something animates, something exalts, as the phrase is here, the holy person, one who's entered the stream, which cannot be defined in ordinary terms. All our language is derived from the world of grasping and grasped, from the world of ego clinging and that which is clung to. So what exalts the holy persons is something that goes completely beyond our normal mode of understanding. But the word exalts is the one I really want to bring your attention to. Exalts. The word pravavita contains a great wealth of meanings, and exalts is the best I can do, says Konza. One could also say, are glorified by, draw their strength from, owe their distinction to, or derive their dignity from. The idea is that the holy persons have arisen from the unconditioned, have been produced from it, are brought forth by it. It is as a result of their contact with the unconditioned that they become mighty and powerful and that they thrive. It is by means of the unconditioned that they prevail and excel. And finally, they are recognized, characterized, or defined by it. In a sense, they are revealed by it. It is their true nature to be the unconditioned. So I think this enlarges our understanding of what we mean by Adhisthana, a force, so to speak, that comes from beyond our normal framework of understanding, our normal way of interpreting the world, that indeed cannot be interpreted. That is what Adhisthana is. You're not making contact with anything personal, in a sense. It's not charisma, as I said yesterday. It's not authority in the status sense. It's something that lifts the individual up, coming from, well, from the unconditioned, in the language that's used here. So that helps us to understand a little bit better what it is to experience Adhisthana. It's not something you experience with the thinking mind. It's not something you experience, as it were, with intelligence or with the intelligence in the narrow sense, perhaps in the more 18th century or earlier sense. But it's something experienced completely directly. It can even be contrary to your wishes, as it was in the case of the five ascetics who the Buddha met in the deer park at Shravasti. So it's this Adhisthana, this absolute working through the Buddha, working through the great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, working through the great Gurus, working in our own particular case through our teacher Urgyen Sangharakshita. It is that is Adhisthana and that animates our movement. It's the real meaning and purpose of our Tri Ratna community and order. So this is, yes, the real meaning of what we're doing. And you could see it as expressing itself in terms of Sangha. I've been thinking about this quite a lot. I gave a talk at the convention in Bodh Gaya in which I discussed this theme. The way in which when we come together in a sufficiently elevated way, when we're all really in tune with the ideal that we share, something comes into existence, you could say, metaphorically speaking, that is more than any of us as individuals. Something comes into view that many people will share, a sense of something that we are that is more than us, and that comes from our conjunction, from our meeting with each other. I think this is so important because there's such a strong tendency in our modern Western culture to a highly individualized interpretation of experience. It's very, very interesting moving between the two cultures of India and, where's the other place? West, England, Britain, West generally. People in India conceive of themselves in relationship. They don't speak of themselves in purely individual terms, to a fault, frankly. They go too far to that extreme. But they see themselves as relational. This is the traditional way of seeing yourself. You see yourself as a son, a daughter, a husband, a mother, a father, blah, etc. You see yourself in terms of your relationships, belonging to a particular culture and so on. But we tend to the other extreme. We see ourselves in isolated, personal terms. We define ourselves almost entirely often in those terms. And this invades our Dhamma life. And we interpret the Dhamma in these terms. This is why I think we need to be so careful of the language of individual attainment, the language of individual realization, and so on. You can't avoid it because it's a feature, it's an aspect. But one has to be so careful that does not become something private, personal, my stream entry. But stream entry is the very denial of separate selfhood. So the most powerful means we have, usually, to provoke us beyond our self-clinging is other people. It's not the only one, and it's not enough on its own, of course, unless there's a great deal of deep meditation, a great deal of deep reflection, a great deal of deep listening to the Dhamma, thinking about the Dhamma. It won't work. Just being with other people is mere gregariousness. But our interaction with other members of the Sangha is one of the most powerful tools we have, one of the most powerful practices we have, to put it that way. It's also an expression, not just a practice, for transcending ourselves. And when we can bring Sangha into existence, genuine Sangha into existence, it enables each of us to go beyond ourselves. This is one of Bhante's chief gifts to the world. He has, from himself, by himself, enabled a genuine Sangha to come into existence, a Sangha to come into existence, which at moments is a real Sangha, is a genuine Sangha. That's one of his greatest gifts to us. His adhisthana, so to speak, lifts us above ourselves so that we experience for a while something that is, we can only define it as Sangha. In my talk at Bodh Gaya, I coined this term, partly suggested by my new secretary, Maitreya Nagarjuna, this term Sanghakaya. A very interesting term, very, very interesting, because, of course, it's formed on an analogy with Dharmakaya. And I see no reason why this term should not follow. Kaya, of course, means body, but it's not its primary meaning. Kaya in Sanskrit and Pali has the meaning of an aggregate. It's very close, actually, to skanda. It means something that's put together and has a distinct identity, because all the bits sort of hang together. It also has the meaning of an object of attention, even the object of desire. And Bhante has very strongly stressed the need that we have for what he calls a transcendental object. I find this really interesting. We experience within a framework of subject-object clinging, a subject who clings, an object which is clung to, grahaka and grahya, seizer and seized. That's the framework of our normal perception. Everybody does it. It's what we normally do. And within that framework, we have to work. Our Dhamma life is lived within that framework to begin with until we enter the stream. But something has to enter into that framework and participate in that framework that points beyond it. Do you see what I mean? You have to have an object that itself is more than an object that points to something that goes beyond subject-object clinging. That is the transcendental object. If we didn't have such a transcendental object, you can't direct your efforts. You can't have a practice. You can't sustain a sort of discipline. You can't have a purpose, because within the framework of subject-object clinging, desire draws us to the object. So there has to be an object that we're drawn to that goes beyond the framework of desiring grasping. So the transcendental object is the kaya. The transcendental object is the, you could say, the Dhammakaya, of course, that's familiar to us. You could even talk about the Buddhakaya. Of course, Dhammakaya and Buddhakaya are quite closely associated in the Trikaya doctrine. But why not talk about the Sanghakaya? An experience of something that we encounter, first of all, as ordinary clinging beings, which points beyond us. So we come together. You know, you have all the normal reactions and attractions of getting together with order members. Well, for me, attractions and repulsions. I don't know about the rest of you. You know, oh no, not the order again. That sort of feeling. And oh no, not him, not her. But suddenly you realize that something has come about which is beyond all that. And there's a sort of resistance to it and a movement towards it. That, in my coinage, is Sanghakaya. And it's that Bhante has brought into being through his creation of an order, of a Sangha. And which is animated, is initially animated by his Adhisthana, and then becomes itself the vehicle of Adhisthana. It's as if it becomes independently a source of Adhisthana. People can even come into contact with the Sangha and experience Adhisthana, a spiritual power which surprises them, takes them by surprise, astonishes them. So this is a vital contribution of Bhante. He's made this Sangha come into existence, or he's sparked us off to bring Sangha into existence, because of course he can't do it, but his sustaining power has animated the Sangha until this point. Of course, that sustaining power will be there as long as we remember him, as long as we keep in contact with him by memory, when he's gone from us. Well, that sustaining power will be accessible to us, just as the Buddha's memory is still a sustaining power for us. And this is one of the major importances of this place, that it is a focus, one of the principal, perhaps the principal focus for our connecting with Bhante's Adhisthana. He clearly thinks that's very, very important. After all, he had no desire to leave Madhyamaloka, believe it or not. He didn't want to go. He's very happy there. Everything was where he wanted it. At his age, a move is really, really painful and difficult. We didn't force him. We didn't grab him and put him in the car and take him away. We told him, we can buy this place. Do you want to go? And he said, I don't want to go, but I think it's the best thing. So it's quite important. Bhante, in a sense, sacrificed his own interests, his own immediate personal interests, to come here. And it's been quite a strain for him, the move, you know, obviously. So yes, this place is a focus for keeping in contact with Bhante's Adhisthana, and I hope will be for many generations to come, if we all do our work properly. But it can't be the only one. Of course it can't. It's just a kind of extra aid that we can draw on, and future generations can draw on, places associated with him, places strongly associated with him, as this no doubt will be, where all his belongings, his books, his murti, what do you call them? Buddha figures are. Bhante's Adhisthana will still sustain us in the future. But it's not enough to draw on Bante's memory, as it were, and his imaginative connection with him, as important as that will be for future generations. We need a great many more resources if we are to sustain Sanghakaya, if we are to sustain that Adisthana as a living force amongst us. And it seems to me that the recognition of what these forces are imposes upon us all quite explicit duties and disciplines. It cannot be sustained simply spontaneously. It'll last for some time spontaneously, but it'll gradually fissiparate. It'll gradually split into many different streams and strands. No doubt that will happen eventually. But the longer we can sustain a united order, which is the expression of that that spirit of Sanghakaya, that Adisthana that initially emanated from Bante and from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the Buddha himself, as long as we can remain united, we can sustain that. So to me it seems that we're at a point where we need to really decide whether we want that or not. Because if we want it, yes, certain duties are imposed upon us. He who wills the ends wills the means. So if you want that unity as a source of sustaining the Sanghakaya, then certain things are imposed upon you. But I haven't made the connection, of course, between unity and the Sanghakaya. But perhaps that's fairly obvious that if we are increasingly distant from each other, if we increasingly don't feel we share enough in common, well, it'll be much more difficult to create the spark out of which Sanghakaya will emerge. You know, many, many good Buddhists. I know many good Buddhists, and I have some good friends amongst other Buddhists. But very rarely do I experience in the midst of other Buddhists the same quality and depth of Sanghakaya as I do within the order to which I belong. When we're united, when we share a great deal in common, it's easier, it's more likely that Sanghakaya will come into existence if we do the right things. We need to work to sustain the unity, the very strong, intense connections with each other, out of which we can transcend ourselves together and experience thereby Sanghakaya. So I'm going to pursue what it is that we need to do by looking at those four lineages. So I think down those four lineages you can see more or less the outlines of what unity implies. Bante himself, in the paper published as What is the Western Buddhist Order in 2009, spoke of unity as depending upon a high degree of commonality of practice. He said he thinks it's only to the extent that we share a high degree of commonality, that we share the same basic practices, it's only to that extent that we will be able to sense our unity. I think we can extend that. I think we can say also that it's only to the extent that we share a high degree of commonality of teaching that we will be able to experience our unity. It's only to the extent that we share a high degree of commonality of practice that we'd be able to share our sense of unity and thereby allow the Sanghakaya to emerge. It's only to the extent that we recognize, accept the responsibilities that are being held and support and encourage those responsibilities, only to that extent will we experience our unity and thereby Sanghakaya. Of course, only to the extent that we share to a very high degree a common flavour of inspiration will we be able to experience that unity. So let me examine each of these in turn. let me look first of all at a high degree of teaching. Perhaps it's fairly obvious, but I think we need to address, even now, within our order, issues arising in relation to this. I was recently in a study group where discussion was going on, and somebody referred to the seventh jnana. And, you know, I look completely blank. And you say, oh, you know the seventh jnana, and explain what it was. I said, I'm really sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about. So he said, oh, you know, in Daniel Ingram's book. I'm sorry, I haven't ever read it. It's not to my taste, frankly. It's a little over-technical and cold for my taste. I don't say that it's not good for others, but my aesthetic sense doesn't take to it. But this person, and it seemed as if it wasn't just him, the centre from which he came, that was their major reference point. So they were sharing a language which no doubt was effective and useful for them, but into which I had no access, and which is not commonly shared. There are a few Ingramites, but it's not shared by everybody. Because whatever it is that they've got from that hasn't been digested into our common system of practice. So you see what I mean? I'm not saying this is wrong and bad and naughty and awful. It may be very good. It may be very useful. But when it's a language which exists sort of detached from the major pool that we share, it becomes quite difficult to interact. We increasingly don't have the same vocabulary. So when we refer to things, we don't know what each other are meaning. And we depend so much on overlapping on a certain range of very basic teachings. For instance, we're all so thoroughly schooled, I hope, in the Bhante's particular understanding of going for refuge to the three jewels. We understand that in a very particular way, which, you know, it's not completely different from everybody else, but it's quite distinctive. And so many of our institutions, our practices, our relations with each other, our very order, is founded upon that particular interpretation, that particular presentation of going for refuge to the three jewels. And if we start to diverge, for instance, in our interpretation of or a presentation of going for refuge to the three jewels, how are we going to talk about readiness for ordination? How are we going to talk to each other about the fundamentals of our Dhamma life? So many other aspects of our teachings we derive from Bhante, and which give us a strong degree of mutual understanding. I can take so much for granted speaking to you, dear brothers and sisters. I know that you will understand so much of what I'm saying because you have the same background as I have. You've studied the same Mitra course. Actually, I never did a Mitra course, but anyway, you've studied the same basic material. You've heard the same lectures. You've read the same books. Yes, we've read other books. I've read ones that you haven't read. You've read ones I haven't read. But we overlap to a high degree in a certain range of teachings, a certain range of presentations. As we diverge, as that range of teachings, as that common vocabulary is lost, we won't be able to understand each other. We'll be less and less easily able to appreciate each other. You know, you sometimes get the impression when you're speaking, I quite often get this impression, that, you know, some of your audience are sort of, Their heads go on one side and they're looking at you like that. I'm not sure about that. That may be, of course, to do with me. I don't dispute that. But sometimes I think it's because we sort of don't quite share the same perspective, and people are interpreting what I'm saying in terms of a different universe of discourse, which is not what I intend. So the more we share a common basic interpretation of the Dhamma, common presentation of the Dhamma, the more we will be united, the easier it will be for us to come together and experience Sanghakaya. It's quite straightforward, really. What about a high degree of commonality of practice? It's very similar, really. Comes to almost the same thing. We've all done the mindfulness of breathing, at least long ago. We've all done the Maitri, what do we call it? Maitri Vikas, Maitri Bhavana, Metta Bhavana, yeah. We've all done the Metta Bhavana. We can't call it Maitri Bhavana in India because Bhavana just means feeling in modern Hindi and Marathi. So we call it Maitri Vikas, which means development. So yes, we've all done the Metta Bhavana. We've done it in the same way. And that means that we've got, you know, from our own particular points of view, roughly the same experience. We share a common consciousness in relation to that practice. We've all done the six-element practice, I hope. We've all done perhaps other of those reflective Vipassana practices. Probably most of us have done, we should have done, some form of Buddha Anusmriti, which, as I said yesterday, for me implies not merely contemplating the Buddha Shakyamuni, but the contemplation of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Manjushri Stuti Sadhana is a form of Buddha Anusmriti. So yes, we share a common set of experiences, which are framed, of course, in a common system. And we understand what we're experiencing in a common way. And we're able to interlocute. We're able to talk to each other and discuss what we've experienced so easily, if we choose to do so. I'm very struck yesterday. I mentioned that I was doing the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana. And I saw a lovely smile spread over Sangadevi's face. And one or two others in the audience who immediately related to what I was talking about. Now, of course, the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana is not a practice that everybody's done. But do you see what I mean? It's an example of that kind of sense of a shared experience. Well, we do have a very major corpus of shared practices. And to the extent that we really engage with those practices and experience what they are directed to, we will understand each other. Of course it's never going to be absolute, and of course it's not closed. And we'll come on to that probably tomorrow, what it means for it to be open. So please don't think I'm merely preaching conservatism. Not merely preaching conservatism. I am preaching conservatism because conservatism's a good thing. Well, in the sense that the Buddha said on his last tour, do not overturn any old-time practices, ordinances, it's translated, isn't it? That's one of the bases for the unity of the Sangha, the harmony of the Sangha, that you don't unnecessarily, you could say, adding in, overturn what has been done in the past. But times change. Experience changes, and there needs to be development. But I'll come on to that tomorrow. For the time being, I want to emphasize the commonality of practice so that we have, as our basic corpus, practices that everybody has done and does fairly regularly, recurs to those practices. Beginners do mindfulness of breathing and Metta Bhavana, sorry. I do it, it's just I call it something different. And that means you've got a sort of solidarity with them. They know they know that you do what they do. They know that that practice is sort of runs right the way through the movement, that everybody does it. They know that Bhante does it. They know that Bhante did it for years and so on. So these practices give us a basic shared experience, not just of practice, but of experience, of results. Because if you're doing these wretched practices, they bring some result. Otherwise, why on earth are we doing them? You actually experience Maitri, as it were, from that point of view, through that medium. Well, Maitri's Maitri. It doesn't matter how you experience it. But You experience it from that point of view, and that gives you then a sort of a connection with everybody else who does that. It becomes more complex when you move on to a spiritual death, I think, because I think that is more particular, and that's another rather interesting discussion that maybe I'll enter into tomorrow. I think it's more difficult to determine what brings real spiritual death to people. I think many different things work for different people. But as long as we share, for instance, the six element practice, it's a very important perspective on our existence, what it is to be a human being, what it is to have a relationship with the material world, what it is to be conscious. And we share that. We all know what we mean, more or less. And yes, of course, the Buddha too. Bhante said to me last year, he thought that most order members had no idea who the Buddha was. I don't know why I dropped that in. Anyway, our Buddha Anusmriti is an attempt to have an idea who the Buddha is, to really experience the Buddha as completely transcending our normal modes of understanding and experience. We're trying to pick up the Buddha's Adhisthana. And we do it in more or less the same ways. Again, it can't be completely pinned down. But if there's a basic corpus of practices that we do that are intended to bring that about, and then they diverge, they vary, they effloresce, well, yes, that's going to happen. But we share something in common. So, if we share that in common, it'd be far easier for us to experience our unity and to experience thereby what comes from that unity when we're at our best, this experience of Sanghakaya. What about responsibility? I find this very, very interesting because it's quite recently that we've got together a structure. We've clarified a structure in the last 5 years. There's been a sort of structure, but it's not been very well defined or not very clearly defined because it was still sort of emanating from Bhante. It was still a sort of waves coming off Bhante. But in the establishment of the International Council and the National Councils and the relationship of the three strands and the clearer definition of responsibilities, the system of our order and movement come into solid shape. Well, not solid shape, but at least more defined shape. And my own experience of that, mainly in India, but also in the West, has been a sort of massive collective sigh of relief, as if it's much clearer how we stand in relationship to each other, who's responsible for what, how that responsibility is held, who they're answerable to, and then we can set that aside and just meet as order members, if you see what I mean. I've noticed this particularly in India, because the movement in India has developed in a very different way. Of course, without the immediate presence of Bhante all the time. I won't go into all the ins and outs of it. It's quite a complex story. But it's taken some time, really, for Indian order members to stop looking to the big white people, to be frank. And it's understandable why. Because it's not clear how responsibility is distributed apart from them. Just as it wasn't clear in the early days how responsibility was distributed apart from Bhante. And what I've noticed, especially over the last couple of years, is everything beginning to settle down in India in that way. And also Indian order members taking the major responsibility. I am not on the National Council in India. Karuna Maya has just resigned from it. It's all in Marathi. We now have 5 Indian public preceptors. I leave them and just do what they tell me. You did. You believed me. Anyway, they think it all out, and then we discuss in English. But they've got their own way of talking, which is very different. They don't seem to sort of follow such a directed thread, but they talk about everything that needs to be talked about, and they come up with very wise and appropriate decisions and interpretations and so on. And I think it's this structure that has enabled that to happen, where all the responsibilities are clear and they're in a clear relationship to each other. It's clear where you go if you've got something that you want to raise. Of course, as with all structures, every one of us has to take the major vow of patience, because such structures are automatically slow. But they work. I'm sure they will work. I'm no doubt in the future there'll be troubles and so forth. Hopefully I'll be back again as a new Mitra and won't notice. That is after my death. I'm not thinking of resigning and coming back as a Mitra, just to be clear. These structures enable responsibilities to be clear and to be clearly held in a context, in a related context. And that helps us to be united, because we can set aside our anxieties, our fears, our struggles, our stresses, our strains. They will go on. But we know that there's a structure that contains it all. And we need to work with those structures, with patience, with clarity, with metta, and with quite a dose of humour. We need to work with those structures and activate them, use them. And if we're in positions of responsibility, to see what those responsibilities are fully and to use them in that context. This, I think, will help the whole order and movement to be united. Very obvious, for instance, with a chapter system. We don't yet have a clear written constitution, although the outlines are pretty clear. You relate to your chapter has its chapter convener, your chapter convener relates to regional order conveners, etc., etc. So there's a way of consulting the whole order, a way of points being made from any point in the order all the way through the system. And that enables us, I think, to relate to each other in a much more harmonious way, so that we can experience our unity. Unity based on the lineage of inspiration is far more difficult to define and speak about. And really, you could say that it is to some extent the product of the other lineages, although at the same time it's the product of our individual efforts, if you see what I mean. I think it's quite important to realise inspiration is flavoured, if you see what I mean. Inspiration isn't just inspiration. I hope Pramodita won't mind, but I can't share the inspiration that he clearly derives from Arsenal, is it? Am I saying the right thing? Yeah, Arsenal. I just can't get that sort of inspiration, nor can I from anybody else. I can't even think of any other footballers. I don't get any inspiration from football at all. I don't doubt that Pramudita does get some inspiration, which is more than just liking Arsenal winning. I think it's quite interesting. It's just a beautiful game, they say. And so there's something more than just the game. But I'm not talking about inspiration in that sense, or getting inspired by, I don't know, Mahler, not Bach, or Bach, but not Mahler. I don't mean inspiration in that sense. Or rather, that's a very particular version of the inspiration I'm talking about. There's a shared flavour to the inspiration that we have in the order that it's quite difficult to really catch in what way it is particular to us. Bante talks, doesn't he, in that very, very important paper, What is the Western Buddhist Order, of there being a distinctive, how does he put it, atmosphere or flavour running the way through our movement. When you come in contact, you feel it. You feel you've got the same sort of mood in the deeper sense. The Dhamma mood is the same, with different shades and different colours and different music or whatever. But the inspiration, you can definitely feel the similarity of it. Again, I'm so vividly aware of that working in both India and the West, that so much that's different, and people do have such differences of approach. My friend Maitreya Nagarjuna, after his last visit to England, said that he was asked what he thought the difference between India and the West was. He said, well, in the West, in India rather, people respond to the Dhamma with their hearts, and sometimes that connects with their heads. In the West, people respond to the Dhamma with their heads, and sometimes that connects with their hearts. But it's the same Dhamma, and the response in the end is the same. If it does connect, if both head and heart connect, it's the same inspiration, the same flavour. And for me, this is really clear. I talk exactly the same things in India as I talk here. A lot of what I said last night is what I said a week ago in Bordaran. Just the same things. Their faces light up in ways that, I'm sorry to say, brothers and sisters, yours don't. You look so intelligent, though, of course. But as you say exactly the same things in more or less the same words. I don't make concessions. I don't angle differently or whatever. Yeah, I talk about Murchi and, chili and Puranpuri and tigers and things like that. Monkeys. I talk a lot about monkeys, the major source of illustration of human behaviour, because they live in the jungle just behind the retreat centre. It's really alarming. But it's the same inspiration that they share with us, as I'm sure many of you will have experienced at Bodh Gaya when you were there. That there's no difference in that dimension. There's so many differences in every other. So that shared inspiration comes from our response to our teacher and to our active work to remain united in teaching, practice, and responsibility, the structure of responsibility. That shared inspiration comes from that. It comes from our deep going for refuge to the three jewels, our activation of those practices and teachings for ourselves. And it comes from us being loyal disciples of Sangharakshita. Bhante, in that paper, which is a mine of unmined material, I really think it's worth everybody going through it again now that we've all sort of calmed down a bit and sort of digested it without realising it. It's worth going through it again and just seeing a lot of the detail of what Bhante says. For instance, you know, famously he defines the order as the community of his disciples and disciples of disciples practising in accordance with his particular presentation of the Dhamma. But he also says that he says, I expect of my disciples that they will faithfully study my teaching, faithfully put it into practice, and faithfully hand it on to others. And if we do that, of course, down the lineage of practice, the lineage of teaching, lineage of responsibility, the lineage of inspiration will certainly be continued. This is the choice that we really have to make. I'm sure that this is not a problem. I hope it's not a problem for anybody here by virtue of you taking the responsibilities that you hold. But I think the order as a whole needs to recognise the responsibility that goes with maintaining Sanghakaya. If you care about it, if you want it, you're going to have to work. You're going to have to make sure that your own individual inspiration and individual practice has sufficient commonality with the practice of others. Your own approach to the teaching has sufficient commonality with the teachings that others follow that you can feel your identity, your solidarity with them at the level of Sanghakaya. This means work. If you found inspiration in, you know, Daniel Ingram, since I mentioned him, that's great, that's fine. But you've got to make the steps to integrate that. You've got to make the steps to find a way to bring that into relationship with the common store of practice. Again, I will say much more about this tomorrow. But what I want to really sort of emphasize today is the work that's involved, which I believe is implicit in our ordination, the commitment we make at ordination. For most of us, when we were ordained, for certainly somebody like me, when I was ordained, it was quite easy. Bante was there. You know, one was just devoted to Bante most of the time. Not all the time, most of the time, or at least in theory. But maybe as time has gone on, it's become less easy to sense that unity through a single body of people. And that means we've got to do more work to integrate ourselves again and again, and to ensure that we participate in this high degree of commonality of teaching, practice, responsibility, and inspiration. It's not an absolute degree of commonality. If it was an absolute degree of commonality, frankly, I'm not sure I want to belong to it. But a sufficiently high degree of commonality for us to really feel we're united, to really feel that we understand each other, that we share a basic reference points, dhammic reference points. So it's easy for us to come together, put ourselves aside, and experience Sanghakaya. So if you like, my question, it's rhetorical, I'm not implying that you won't answer yes, but my question is, do we want that sort of unity? Do we connect that sort of unity with this experience of Sanghakaya? Do we see the point of it, the value of unity? And are we willing to do the work to integrate our private, personal inspiration and interest with that common corpus? To be frank, I think that any sensible person will debate whether it is worth it, if you see what I mean. I mean, I'm sure that it is worth it, but I think it's worth pausing and just reflecting. It's a lot of work, and at times it can even be a little oppressive or feel a little oppressive, but we have to work to make it not oppressive and to experience it as the fulfillment of something you value very, very highly indeed. So, rhetorically, I'm posing for you those questions. Do you experience, or do you believe that degree, that sort of unity is a basis for the transcendence that I call Sanghakaya in this context? Do you value that? Is that important to you? Do you agree that a high degree of commonality in these three areas is necessary in order to preserve that unity so that transcendence can be experienced? And are we willing to take the steps that will keep that high degree of commonality in being? I shall be interested to hear what you all have to say. It'd be rather embarrassing if you all decide it isn't, because I don't know what I shall be in common with or who I shall be in common with. I'm sure I'll find somebody. But I think we need to consciously take it on in a way that perhaps we haven't really done till now. It hasn't seemed quite necessary. But myself, I'm more and more aware, I have been for the last 10 years, 13 years, sometimes rather hysterically, aware of the vociferative tendency of just human groups, even human communities. I put it as an analogy to Bante a long time ago. My naval background is showing here. It's like a fleet of ships, sailing ships, that are sailing according to a certain compass setting on the open sea, but every one of their compasses is slightly off in a slightly different way. So without anybody deciding to, without anybody even really noticing, the ships are gradually sliding apart. And somebody says, the ships are gradually sliding apart. He said, no, look, my compass setting is accurate. I can shout to him over there. He can shout to him over there. No, it's fine. But imperceptibly, so slowly, they're moving apart. And that has been my great fear over these last years. I feel I even contributed to that in my own carelessness at times. But I value so highly what comes about when we come together that I want it to be preserved, at least with those who want it to be preserved. And I'd sort of rather people came to the conclusion they don't want it, and that's fine for them, but maybe they need to decide what they want and where they want to be. So please, let's discuss this and see what comes out of it. Namo Buddhaya.